You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, June 26, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. On the program today, Philip Murawski, author of Never Let a Serious Crisis Go to Waste, How Neoliberalism Survived the Financial Meltdown. Also on the program today, SCOTUS drops two cases, or I should say two decisions on two cases. The recess appointment case and the abortion clinic buffer zone case we will discuss today. Also, the Army says they have no evidence that Bo Bergdahl gave any information to the Taliban. And I suspect many of you will be podcasting today's show because of, in the words of Ann Coulter, the nation's moral decay that will lead you all to watch USA versus Germany in the World Cup. And an update, apparently that Scott Walker supporter who was charged with major voter fraud had amnesia.
What?
I'm not kidding. I don't know where I was. Germany and U.S. Kickoff probably just moments ago based upon the looks on the faces of Michael and Matt in this room. We also have the story. IKEA apparently has no idea how to run their business. They simply have no idea what the relationship between worker productivity and pay is because they have raised their base salary, or they plans to do within a couple of months. We will get to that story as well, as well as those two rulings on from the Supreme Court. Essentially, in Coakley v. McCullen, the idea of having a 35-foot buffer zone to protect women who are entering an abortion clinic has been struck down as being too big because, you know, those people, those nice people who want to counsel women as to their decision to do with their bodies what they will, they just need to be, you can't be that far away or they won't be able to nicely counsel them. And we will also talk about the fact that the Supreme Court has their own buffer zone, which apparently is a little bit further because they don't need counseling in the same way. Also, the implications of the Supreme Court striking down the notion of recess appointments during a pro forma Senate recess over 3 days has been struck down. The real implications for this will probably not happen for 5 years. And, of course, will make it impossible for President Obama to appoint anybody in the event that the Senate is taken over by the Republicans. With all that said, we're going to take a quick break, and we will be back with Professor Philip Murawski. This is going to be a weedy one, folks. One of those arguments that I'm going to try and understand in the process of trying to help you understand. And those are sometimes some of my favorite interviews. Hopefully this will work out that way. All right, we'll take a break. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Seder from of the Majority Report. Sorry. On the phone, it is a pleasure to welcome to the program Philip Murawski. He is a professor from Notre Dame University, historian and philosopher, and author of Never Let a Serious Crisis Go to Waste, How Neoliberalism Survived the Financial Meltdown. Welcome to the program, Professor.
Hi. Good to be here.
So let's now... you're providing an intellectual history of neoliberalism, an explanation of how it's transformed our everyday life, and how that has led to its surviving and I would argue also, I guess, flourishing following the financial crisis, and the failures of any cohesive opposition to this. I guess it's not simply an economics, it's sort of a world philosophy, I guess. But let's start with the Montpelerin Society so that we can get a sense of just what neoliberalism is and from whence it came.
Yeah, okay. It's true that most people don't have a good idea about neoliberalism, and they sort of think it's a left swear word. You know, it's just all the stuff that they don't like. But there is an elaborate history to it, and it sort of begins with the Mont Pelerin Society, which was formed in a kind of a rump group in the 1930s in reaction to the Depression, but then the war puts a stop to it, and then it's reconvened in a serious way in 1947. And it still exists today, by the way, which people, I think, also don't realize very much. What it was meant to do was it was meant to sort of, you know, buck up the spirits of the right in the period of both the Great Depression and then, of course, the war afterwards, in which they were seen as largely intellectually bankrupt, right? I mean, all of their notions were shown in some way to be wrong. People didn't take them very seriously. And by the way, I bring this up now, hint, hint, because this may be the situation of the left. And so what they did was they realized that they had to rethink their entire project. And one of the first things that they started to rethink was this whole idea that laissez-faire was the center of their political universe, that they all believed that there was a kind of a natural market and a sphere for the state as a kind of a minimalist night watchman state. A lot of people on the right believed that back then. And what was interesting about them is they convened together a bunch of economists, certainly, but a bunch of philosophers and sort of, you know, general political people as well to rethink this. And the people that, the person who convened it was Friedrich Hayek, who maybe your listeners have heard of. But there were a number of interesting people there, all of whom who had input into this. For example, Milton Friedman, who, again, some people have heard mm-hmm. of, George Stigler, Lionel Robbins, Karl Popper, shows you their philosophers there, Gary Becker, Richard Posner, which people, although that's later, Robert Barrow, so forth. So there's a large number of people who are involved in this.
Ludwig von Mises? I mean, in
well, there's a, if you want me to tell that story, I mean, Mises was involved early, too. He was a representative of that older laissez-faire school, and as he attended the first few meetings, he realized that he was being sort of frozen out of the action, that they didn't like his story anymore. And there's this famous story where he storms out of one of the meetings shouting, "You're all socialists," which, of course, is the worst thing you could say to these people. So,
I actually think that's very important for people to understand on some level, because we associate von Mises and Hayek, I think, as being the fathers in some respect, or at least I do, and you're obviously a far better position to make this assessment. But as at least I think in this country, they are perceived as being the fathers of the sort of libertarian movement, I guess.
We might as well clear that up. Yeah, the labels that Americans use are amazingly confused about politics. What is a liberal? What is a libertarian? And of course, what is a neoliberal? So let's try to make it a little bit more clear. Is that eventually what happened to neoliberalism was it's a political position that does not believe in laissez-faire anymore. It believes in the market, but it believes that you have to have a strong state, and that the neoliberals have to take over the strong state to impose the kind of market society that they think would be ideal.
And is that why von Mises storms out? Because he...
Exactly, right. Okay. So part of the problem is that there's a kind of an older classical liberalism that thinks that, if the government just somehow got out of the way, the market would naturally develop in its appropriate directions. And you see, I think the neoliberals no longer feel that way, that they understand that it's a constructivist project. You got to get in there and make it. Okay, you got to make it happen. You got to change the world. And by the way, changing the world also means changing business and the way business people think, which of course is another difference from that earlier classical liberalism. That I think a lot of people tend to talk about neoliberalism as though it were just simply the projection of the wishes of a capitalist class or something like that. And while certainly there are a large number of rich people who paid for this organization and kept it going and still do, the feeling of this core of neoliberals was that they had to change the minds also of their patrons. They had to make them think differently as well. And, the important thing to see about this, and I'll come back to libertarianism, the important thing to see about this is a long game. They aren't in it for this year. They're not in it for a five-year horizon. They're in it for the long term. And they organize as though they're in it for the long term. And let me just briefly describe what that organization eventually looks like. It takes time to build. It doesn't all happen in 1947. What happens first is the Mont Pelerin Society. And then they realize that they need to not only think deep thoughts about, what their politics are, but they need to have those thoughts kind of translated into specific national situations and specific national politics. And so what that means is that they build up a kind of an outer ring of think tanks. And I think think tanks are a really important innovation of the neoliberals in a lot of ways. So, for example, they build up in Britain the IEA, in America, Heritage, Cato. They even have a think tank to start think tanks in other countries. It's called the Atlas Foundation. See, which shows you that they're thinking long game.
Now Heritage and Cato, or at least I know Cato didn't start, I think, until the early 70s. And Heritage, around that time as well. Was there, during the interim period, or was it simply over the course of those, 20-some-odd years that they developed this understanding that they needed in some respects, I guess, a conduit for these ideas?
Yeah, it took time. It didn't happen all at once. I mean, there's, of course, a fascinating history of this. Some of it starts in Britain, of all places, with a guy named Anthony Fisher, who comes to Hayek and says, "Look, I want to help out." And Hayek says, well, look, you know, the part of the problem in Britain is that there is no place to kind of support and curry these kind of ideas. And so one of the first ones that's formed is the IEA, the Institute for Economic Analysis in Britain. And then that becomes a pattern for other ones being formed later. And I just want to also suggest that it doesn't stop there. It's not just the think tanks. The think tanks develop another ring of essentially translating organizations, like dedicated political firms to AstroTurf organizations and so forth. So all of this stuff about the Koch brothers and the Tea Party and so forth is part of the story of the greater developing and building out of organizations of this neoliberal project.
And so, perhaps it's because I'm also radiocentric. I would add that you know, the Heritage Foundation, through places like Hillsdale College and others, also support ultimately right-wing talk radio in this country.
Yeah, I didn't want to go into that, but I mean, it's pretty obvious that the Fox Network and a number of other things are also, you know, part of the rethinking of how this building out of ideas is going to work. And I should come back to the reason why ideas are so important for the neoliberals. See, and this is one reason why they're not like kind of standard neoclassical economists. And I know this often confuses people. It confuses people like David Harvey, for example, that neoclassical economists are not necessarily the same as the neoliberals. Not going to go into neoclassical economics unless you want me to.
Well, yeah, I mean, let's, I mean, just, you know, for the sake of, you know, because my audience is, you know, we talk about these things fairly regularly, but for the sake of a lay audience, I mean, just when we say, you know, the state functions as a night watchman for the market, let's say, and we talk about neoclassicism, just if you could, a rudimentary definition.
Okay. Sure, no problem. Neoclassical economics is older, much older than neoliberalism. It starts in the 1870s, and here's another weird story. It starts off as an imitation of physics, strangely enough. You probably don't want me to go into that. But anyway, it slowly becomes the orthodoxy in economics, sort of by the 30s and 1940s. And it's this whole story of utility maximization. And that classical liberal story is very much associated with neoclassical economics. So, for example, they think that, you know, there should just be a night watch in state. Sometimes there might be these market failures, right, that need to be fixed. A number of people on the left still like this kind of language, so, I mean, you know, it crosses over. But basically, what it is, it's a very deterministic story about equilibrium, and that's what the market does, okay?
And so if I could just interpret the neoclassical idea of economics is that the market efficiently allocates resources.
Exactly.
The old, I guess, the classical liberal perspective is that there's the market largely reallocates assets efficiently, but there are times it breaks down, and so we need to step in to make sure that it doesn't this market failure doesn't bring the whole system down.
Yeah, that's a fair characterization. Now let's compare it to neoliberalism. Neoliberalism, as I said, only starts in the 30s and 1940s. It starts partly with some economists, but with some philosophers. And they come up with a large number of interesting new doctrines, and that's one reason why I had to write a book, right? But one of the central ones, and the one that's going to help us understand this, the distinction, is that they change the idea of what a market is and what it does. They're not interested in that kind of idea of efficient allocation between means and ends anymore. They think the market, by and large, is a super information processor that knows more than any human being ever could. You may think I'm making a joke, but I'm not. This is written in a large number of places. Matter of fact, it's central to Hayek's own doctrine, okay? And this has all kinds of implications. One is it's their argument against socialism. You see, socialism can't work because no one can ever know enough about the economy to plan it, because the market always knows more than everybody else. Bang. There's your argument against socialism. But it's deeper than that, too, because it's different from neoclassical economics, because basically people don't know enough themselves to really be, in a sense, the entire captains of their own fate. That people are intrinsically ignorant in neoliberalism. And so one of the things that has to happen is that you have to learn that the market knows more than you could ever know. In other words, you have to be brought around to that. And that's why neoliberalism is also a theory of what it means to be a person, which, of course, you know, is not so important in the earlier neoclassical doctrine.
It is essentially almost like akin to just the idea of nature, something that we can't possibly know all the things we can know certain aspects of it, but it exists almost a priori, and it has a sort of an understanding is that basically the idea when we talk about?
Yeah, it's a little more complicated than that. Let me try to do it one way that I do it in the book. Is that, and by the way, I'm not the first to talk about this aspect. I mean, if any of your listeners are familiar with Michel Foucault, mm-hmm. he actually was on to this aspect way ahead of other people, which is one reason why he's kind of interesting and amazing. Basically, Foucault realizes that the implication of this market as the super information processor is that the neoliberal agent has to be recast to be an entrepreneur of the self. See, because you're a flawed thinker, you can't believe that you have an intrinsic sort of true self that you're just coming to discover. Instead, you kind of have to accept these little packets of truth for the market, what is the truth, and adjust yourself to them. So there's no unique true self that you should remain faithful to. Everything that about you can be outsourced or invested in. You have no class identity, since everything is fair game to be erased. Now, another point that I make in the book is, even though I'm doing intellectual history, I'm also interested in talking about why does it seem that we live in a neoliberal culture when most people, you know, can't be bothered to read all these guys and read Hayek and so forth. And that's because this has developed to the point where there are all kinds of ways for people to learn about neoliberalism without really, you know, having any intellectual interest in politics. And I take this from people like Ilana Gershon. She has a lovely set of articles about how Facebook is training wheels to learn how to be a neoliberal agent. And let me just run it by you so you can see that it helps you understand what neoliberal agency is. What Facebook does is it takes your information for free and it sells it to others for a profit. So first you learn that that's okay, all right? Then the next thing that happens is that, let's say that you say some things about yourself that are embarrassing or wrong, or, you know, you post embarrassing pictures, whatever. It's up to you to fix it. Facebook has no responsibility for that, okay? Then you construct a profile from relatively stereotypic materials. You try to measure your worth by attracting, quote-unquote, friends with artificial metrics. And then these algorithms, once you get kind of, you know, looped into Facebook, force you to constantly update your profiles, teaching you that there's no coherent, stable self. And indeed, what do most people try to do on Facebook? Well, they try out a new identity, right? One that's not really them, but something they might want to be, okay? All of this is a wonderful example of teaching people how to be a neoliberal agent, and not, by the way, in believing the classical liberal idea that you had to find yourself.
Right. And, you know, I mean, what's interesting to me, particularly about this part of your book in terms of the way it's transformed our everyday life, is that one of the things that we have been talking about repeatedly and returning to this notion is that over the past 30 years, at one point, money has become such an ascendant value in our culture that all other value systems seem to have gone out the window. And I come from an entertainment background, and I saw this in the course of things like independent films, where there was a time early in the 80s and the 90s where you would make an independent film, and almost despite it not having commercial value, it would be celebrated, and sometimes almost in opposition to that. And something changed over those years that changed where everything was valued in some way by its commercial value. And then what happens subsequent to that is that everyone starts to aim for that as what they consider artistic success.
I think that's an interesting question, and it's kind of a hard question, so I hope you don't mind if I suggest a couple of different ways to think about it. You know, one way to think about it is this kind of Michael Sandel way, right? Is that there's, you know, there are spheres that are appropriate to the market and spheres that are inappropriate to the market. So, like, you know, we don't sell babies, supposedly, and all that kind of stuff, right? And so he just goes on, you know, saying that, you know, these spheres are, of course, fluid but contestable, but those spheres exist. See, neoliberals are different. They don't believe in spheres like that. There is no such thing as society. There are only a market which tells you what information, what truth is. And then there are all these people who are relatively fluid and don't have any kind of real identities. So for them, they don't get upset when, you know, someone else says, oh, well, that transgresses on my moral intuitions or something like that. They just think that all of those things have to learn to be subordinated in some way to, you know, market dictates.
Right. And otherwise, you're simply not participating in society on some level.
Well, right. And that's why the flip side of a lot of neoliberalism is this kind of shaming. I go into this in the book, too. That there's this idea that, you know, the reason why is it so popular that, you know, we have all these entertainment outlets where people are shamed in various ways. You know, I don't want to mention them, but, you know what they are.
Give me an example.
Well, like anything from, you know, Dr. Phil to, okay, you know, all this, you know, this kind of Survivor, all this other kind of stuff where people desperately allow themselves to be shamed for public, public edification. And this shaming is also kind of a neoliberal idea, because the only way that people are going to learn that they're supposed to be, you know, adjustable, they're supposed to be fluid and so forth, is that, you know, we have these kind of stilted occasions where you see what happens when people aren't fluid, when they insist on resisting and so forth and so on. So, I mean, it's very interesting the way the culture is moving in a very neoliberal direction to have people feel superior to other people who are caught in this kind of trap of, you know, wanting to insist upon themselves as being different.
I mean, it's interesting, too. I mean, you can see this. I mean, the social media does provide such a sort of a perfect manifestation of this. The, as we talk, I have, computers in this office, obviously, that are at any given time during the day are looking at Twitter and are, measuring, one responds to someone with a certain amount of followers and not another, and it is there's this concept of being verified, which is, I guess, sort of a some type of, you're now a duke. It's all this sort of a gamification on some level, which I
right.
guess follows this same principle.
Yeah, I mean, other people have noticed that there's this real sort of convergence between what people tend to believe in Silicon Valley and certain tenets of neoliberalism, such that these tenets of neoliberalism are being, in a sense, written into the software that then turns out to be games that people play to sort of learn about life and so on. I mean, you know, it's very interesting the way in which this develops, not just as a theory of the economy, but also as a theory of culture, how people should, learn to be in in their everyday lives.
All right, so let's return for a moment to this idea of how this spread. You speak of a neoliberal thought collective, and you describe these concentric circles, which we've covered a little bit in terms of starting with a small salon, or I guess it's an organization, and then sort of spreading to these think tanks, and then even going out as far as being disseminated by right-wing radio. But also, somewhere along the line, it begins to permeate other areas, and we'll get to this, I think, in a couple of moments, in terms of how it is also sort of even absorbed in some ways the way that the left perceives of just about everything, but talk about that notion of what a thought collective is, and this illustration of a Russian doll.
Yeah. Okay. By the way, the idea of a thought collective actually comes from history of science. There's this guy named Ludwig Fleck who tried to sort of theorize how one could write the history of science, which wasn't just the history of a few geniuses. Okay. And so I really see myself as trying to do the same thing, that I'm not writing just the history of Friedrich Hayek or just the history of Milton Friedman or something like that, because what's interesting about this is that the thought collective as a whole doesn't organize always around every particular tenet of one person, so that they argue them out, and that's what's interesting about them. That they argue them out, they try them out in different cultural contexts, and they alter them to a certain extent to fit the right context. And there's a million examples of this. For example, they start off because they start off talking about laissez-faire and classical liberals, that they would be hostile to monopoly, and that monopoly would be bad. And I and some other collaborators have demonstrated historically how sometime in the 50s, a bunch of these people decide, no, monopoly is really kind of harmless. And that's the line that we should take from now on, and develop a story as to why that's so. So anyway, so the point of this is that neoliberalism cannot be reduced to the thought of any one person. Now, some people really don't like that aspect of the book, and they say, well, I'm just talking about some kind of conspiracy theory. And I do find that a little disturbing, and one of the problems of the left. I mean, if the left thinks the only way you could talk about political thought is either on the level of the individual, or that politics is somehow just a whole bunch of random events of history that, certain things happen and then stuff comes out, and that there's nothing in between, well, that's one reason why the left loses, it seems to me. That these people understand that they have to have a theory of politics which involves a theory of organization and a theory of coordination of how they will decide what their positions are going to be and how they're going to get played out in particular political contexts. And, let me just give you one example of this, because I think this is a very nice, clean example. I put it in the last chapter. Let's take global warming, which I know we haven't been talking about, but is one of their fascinations, okay? What is the neoliberal position towards global warming? It isn't a single position, and that's what's fascinating about it, that these think tanks run a number of positions simultaneously. One position, and this is the one that everyone on the left knows about and gets upset about, is this denialism.
Right.
That they have the denialism and, they try to deny the science. And that's true. That's part of it. But the point I try to make in the book is that these people are smart. They don't really think they're going to change the science. What is the purpose of denialism? It is to buy time and confuse people so that their other programs can be developed in the longer term. Okay. And so they have medium-term programs as well. And these medium-term programs look like using markets, newfangled markets, to supposedly fix perceived problems of old markets. Now let's get specific. What does that look like in global warming? That looks like this whole idea of cap and trade.
Cap and trade, right.
Which was invented
by the Heritage.
Neoliberal.
Right.
People, the left forgets this, and
right.
It's really distressing. Now, what's interesting about that, I mean, we could do a long time on this, but let's just do it really quickly. What's interesting about that is I would argue that also exists only as a medium term, quote unquote, solution, and that they know ahead of time that it's not going to actually reduce emissions. And in fact, that's the history. If you take a look at, say, the cap and trade in Europe, for example, that they had a elaborate program, you know, they tried to make it work, and basically it did nothing. Okay, I would say that they knew that. They know, so that's for buying time too. And then they have a third solution, and this is the long-term solution in their mind is to let entrepreneurs pursue out-of-the-box solutions.
Right. This is their concept of adaptability, right? In some fashion, that the market will actually provide some type of adaptable solution.
And they know what it is too, because they're promoting it. It's called geoengineering.
Right.
Geoengineering is this kind of spewing lots of, you know, sulfur dioxide up into the atmosphere to supposedly block the sun. And this, you know, most scientists are just outraged at this. I mean, it just sounds totally crazy. So it takes a long time for them to buy a certain number and develop a certain number of scientists who will take this seriously and develop it and turn it into a policy. You see how this is a long-term strategy. And so they're succeeding at that. By the way, they've just recently managed to place somebody at Harvard who's one of the main advocates of geoengineering in the American context. See that? Think about the long-term strategy that takes in order to make this happen. Okay. So here's my point of that long, perhaps overly long story. The point is they're organized, and they, out of their organization, come not one single solution to any problem, but many solutions, some of which are calculated to sort of distract the left and get the left to sign on to, like cap and trade, whereas their long-term solution is their market solution that they think, you know, will take time, but, you know, people will eventually come around to that.
You know, the strategy seems almost analogous to a legal argument you would see in the context of a case. We deny these facts, but in the event that we stipulate these facts, we would argue X, and in the event that we don't argue X, we would also argue Y, so that you control the entire terrain of what the argument ultimately will be. We'll either face you on these grounds, or if we have to stipulate those ultimately. And we saw this in some way, we see this with the Affordable Care Act, right? Because initial position.
No. Although I haven't done as much work on that, but I mean, I would agree with you that basically what they've done is they've managed to occupy the entire space of discussion of healthcare, such that a plan that came out of Heritage in the 90s becomes the Obamacare plan. I mean, see, think about the amount of organization that takes for that to be true, and also the long-term horizon that it takes. I don't want to offend people, but the left has nothing like that, and the left has to wake up.
Well, now, but let me, and I want to sort of to move into that part of the conversation. But one question in terms of the Affordable Care Act, again, to just sort of, I think, provide real world illustrations of different perspectives. There is one part of the Affordable Care Act which is, I think, sort of classically liberal, or I should say. Yeah, classically liberal, and that would be the expansion of Medicaid. In other words, that we have part of the solution for health insurance for everybody is we've created a new type of market here, and perhaps it's liberal. A manifestation to provide subsidies for people under 400% or at 400% of poverty. And then if you fall 133% below poverty, we have Medicaid. That Medicaid seems to be also a liberal response, but the rest of it is sort of dominated by this neoliberal response. We have a market inefficiency. We will then fix it by creating a new market.
Yeah, exactly. You got it. You see that this whole they have a general pattern to their politics. You know, the first part of the pattern is what I think of as creating a fog of confusion. They don't mind that there be all kinds of, you know, misunderstandings of what's going on. That's good from their point of view. The second is this, let's create newfangled markets to fix what people seem to think of as the problem of old markets, right? But both of those are temporary. I wish people would see that those are temporizing solutions. The third solution is we will build this in such a way such that entrepreneurs will be able to come in and create, you know, change the market and change society so that the market will always provide the ultimate solution to the problem. And one, like I say, I haven't worked on the healthcare, but the one that occurs to me is as soon as you have this kind of, you know, elaborate system of sort of semi-marketized insurance for healthcare, of course it's going to fail to a certain extent, right? It's going to. That's all there is to it. And so then they'll be able to come along and say, look, the reason it failed is because it was insufficiently marketized.
Right.
And so what they'll do is they'll get rid of that last bit that they don't like, and it will become an entirely marketized system, largely run through the state. See, that's why these guys aren't they aren't classical liberals. They don't believe that, you know, there should be a night watchman state. They believe the state should build this new market system.
And so let's move into what constitutes opposition to neoliberalism. I mean, I think that, and I think in general, your assessment that the neoliberals are far more cohesive in their in developing response. They also, it seems to me, have the advantage of what their program constitutes, you know, enriches people who then filter the money back in. I mean, money, it seems to me, and I feel like on some level in the past 15 years, we've seen this program has sort of accelerated in its adoption. And I think that seems to me to be a function of money. I mean, even to the extent that we have big money on the left, it is, again, sort of within the context of neoliberal solutions, right? I mean, the cap and trade is pushed by, you know, that is now the liberal position.
Yeah, right.
And there's a lot of people making a lot of money off of that.
Sure, of course.
And so, you know, there's no big money out there to say, hey, you know what we really need to do is just develop a system where we're just using less energy.
Right. I know that the left tends to focus on that, and reasonably so, because it's true that there is big money behind it. But the left can't blame the lack of coherent ideas simply on money. All right? That's one of its modern weaknesses. That when these guys started, they actually were behind the eight ball. They were held in contempt, even by large amounts of the capitalist class back in the 30s and 40s. Okay, what they realized is that they had to have at least a semi-coherent program, which told them what they were going to strive for, which they would then change the minds of the people who funded them. Okay. I don't think the left thinks that way at all. The left just thinks, oh, well, these guys are just some kind of, you know, expression of a capitalist class imperative that's always been there. So, in a sense, the ideas are not as important. It's just the money. I'm disagreeing. They are smart because they realize the ideas can loop around to try to get the money.
But isn't one of the selling parts of their ideas ultimately to that money is that this is going to behoove you?
Yeah, it's. I mean, look, I understand that the interlock has become very tight lately, and in fact, I think even in ways greater than what people appreciate. So, for example, there are some people who have done work on the Tea Party. And they've come up with this important insight that basically a large part of the Tea Party succeeds because it privatizes and commercializes protest itself. So, for example, one of these guys that I read has attended some Tea Party conclaves and realized that about half or more than half of the organizations represented there were either corporations or for-profit entities. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
But the whole point is that what they do is they encourage the Tea Party members themselves to become entrepreneurs.
Absolutely. Many respects, it's a grift. And I think one of the reasons why it has been, I liken the supposed establishment Republicans and the sort of the Tea Party Republicans, essentially the base of the Republican Party, is now two businesses in the context of one industry. But the real fundamental change has just been that you all of a sudden have literally hundreds of millions of dollars pumped into this second industry, and there's so much money flowing through there that everyone are these sort of what do they call them? Social entrepreneurs, I guess.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Of course.
And without that money, though, I mean, you know, to a certain extent, that's what this show is. It's some type of a social activist entrepreneurial ship. But
right.
I don't have the opportunity of getting some of that bigger money because, frankly, a lot of things we talk about in this program are antithetical to. They're just a little too much.
Right.
And so that inhibits it. I'm not suggesting.
Well, I think if I could rephrase what you just suggested, that there are always splits even within the rich. All right. And what the neoliberals understood is that they had to kind of change that in their direction to a certain extent. And then they also had to have ideas which would justify why and attract these people to become part of their story. See, I think the left sort of thinks, or at least the people who are very idealized the Occupy movement, just thought it would kind of spring up from below, and that political thought would also kind of spring up from below, just naturally. Okay, that is the antithesis of how neoliberals understand epistemology and social epistemology. So that is part of, the discussion that we're having right here, is that the money can be channeled, and they believe that.
I guess the thing that I'm having trouble wrapping my head around is that they have a much more attractive, I guess, program to money. And maybe that had, and I would imagine that over the course of the sort of the thought collective, that they responded to that at different times. That
yeah.
The idea
well,
of
another way to think about it is it took 80 years for that to get built up. So to have all of those kids thinking that it's cool to be a libertarian because that makes you a rebel and so forth. I mean, where does that come from? It doesn't just happen.
Right. Well, that's also I want to circle back to that notion of division of labor, because this is really, very important in the context of that the Russian dolls, is that there are people I come across who identify themselves as libertarians who are funded by the Koch brothers. Who the Koch brothers, of course, fight for government action to ultimately benefit them. But at the same time, they also fund a lot of think tanks and writers and whatnot that decry corporate cronyism. And people see that as as some type of hypocrisy or as in conflict with each other. But that's all part of the same program.
Yes, it is all part of it. And by the way, I would like to suggest, and again, I don't want to offend people, but that's a common phenomenon in the history of politics. So if you go back to the early 20th century, I mean, the left, there was a socialist Marxian left, and then there were fellow travelers who were possibly anarchist socialists and so forth and so on. So it's always true that both ends have these kind of uneasy and ambiguous relationships with groups that are kind of semi-opposed to them. And I would argue that the neoliberals and the libertarians are very similar that way. And, you know, we could get into a whole bunch of interesting history here about how they constantly, you're right, they constantly do encourage them, but only up to a point. And then when they decide that, you know, they're going too far, they sort of discourage them. And there are plenty of instances of this in the history of neoliberalism. So, for example, if any of your listeners know about Murray Rothbard, who really was closer to being a libertarian, he was part of the Cato Institute, helped found it. And then when the Koch brothers came along and gave it a lot of money, at first they were encouraging it, but then they sort of, you know, eased those guys out, so that they had to go form their own little clique down at the Mises Institute, you see. And then even more recently, the Koch brothers, because of their policies that they wanted to push, decided that the existing Cato Institute was going in the wrong direction, and see, it's interesting to figure out what that means. And in doing that, basically, they had a purge. So you see, that the relationship between the libertarians and the neoliberals is this kind of fellow traveling relationship that's very uneasy over time. But they're very useful, and, you know, we should understand that the libertarians are super useful to the neoliberals in certain ways.
Well, Philip Murawski, it's been fascinating, and I'd like to, and perhaps sometime soon we can continue the conversation, because I feel like we could go on for hours, and we have yet to really touch ultimately what. And this could be a function of, at the very least, you know, my having to focus on how are we going to get the good numbers for YouTube or Facebook posts.
Yeah. Right. I hear you, brother.
What ultimately, you know, what it would look like to be in opposition genuinely to this neoliberal program and... In some respects, I think we need to do it. Need to have that conversation soon, because there is a sense that it is. It's almost as if one has to step out of the air that we breathe to get a sense of that.
Yeah, we would have to isolate ourselves to a certain extent. I agree.
Philip Murawski, the book is Never Let a Serious Crisis Go to Waste, How Neoliberalism Survived the Financial Meltdown. We'll, of course, put a link to it at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today.
Sure. Thank you.
All right, folks. We will now head into the fun half, which will be dominated by updates on the soccer game.
We are at 0-0 and we're in halftime now.
Oh, well, there we go.
And Portugal is up 1 point against Ghana. And if the results hold, the U.S. will play second in their group but advance to the knockout round.
So, in other words,
We don't have to win this game.
Just have to tie, yes. And if Portugal wins?
Yes.
Because
because Ghana was in...
Right. Okay. All right, well, there you go, folks. I did get, in the middle of that interview, I saw a... Funny I Am from Jay Schiavone saying, can't believe you're having a show. I would imagine you would have been cheering against the Krauts. Picking up on Gary Oldman from yesterday. But folks, we will head into the funner half of the program. And note that it is your support of this program that makes it possible. As of yet, I have yet to find that millionaire, multimillionaire, billionaire who will be financing this program. Perhaps it's because I haven't figured out yet what the argument is. But for now... we rely almost exclusively on your support. So if you can afford to be a be a member, please, majority.fm, your support is crucial. Excuse me. You can also support this program. If you buy crap from Amazon, there is absolutely no reason for you not to buy it. through our link. You can find that at majorityreportkickback.com. Go to majorityreportkickback.com, click on the Amazon link, bookmark it. Always buy your Amazon stuff through there. They know you are have entered through our portal. You will notice no difference, but we get a kickback. That's why we call it majorityreportkickback.com. Of course, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920 is the number. You can IM me at Majority FM or through our app, which, of course, you can get at MajorityApp.com. Majority Report. Wait, what did I say? Majority Report.
It's MajorityApp.com.
Yeah. MajorityApp.com.
And then MajorityReportKickback.com for the Amazon link.
Thank you, Matt. Appreciate it.
Someone here has got to be on top of things.
Absolutely. All right, we'll be back in just a moment.